BCFM Community Radio for Bristol on 93.2 FM. For more information or to listen live on the internet, go to our website at www.bcfm.org.uk. BCFM, your radio.
Hello and welcome to BCFM's Friday Drive Time. I'm Tony Gosling, and coming up in the next hour, my guests and I will be taking a look back at the London bombings of 2005. With one of the biggest Muslim communities outside London and several terrorist raids which made headlines around the world, what does the failure of the 7-7 trials mean for Bristol? Our economics correspondent Martin Summers is here to untangle the economic jargon and give his perspective on the week's news. Also, last year's short war between NATO and Russia for control of Georgia is over, but the war of words continues. Our reporter Marina Morris reports on NATO's current military exercises in Georgia. And to wrap up the show, Jailbird Colin Power and Carl Saxon will pop by to tell us about their attempts as laymen to navigate their way through Britain's legal system. Anyway, to start, I'm joined by author and ex-boffin at London's New Economics Foundation and Bristol Debt Advice Centre, Martin Summers, to give us a community-friendly view of some of the points in this week's news. Hi, Martin.
Hello.
MPs' expenses, is it a media frenzy, as Stephen Fry has said this week?
Well, obviously it is, but it's not just a media frenzy. I obviously, as Tony Benn was saying on the news report earlier, MPs do have to be accountable and they do have to account for their expenses. But what worries me about it is that the news which people aren't concentrating on is that the Bank of England printed another £50 billion this week and said, oh, we're just printing an extra £50 billion. And I think that...
Is this quantitative...
quantitative easing, as they call it, otherwise known as printing money. And this, of course, is the kinds of sums that are being talked about in terms of the financial crisis are beyond normal comprehension. Whereas when you say somebody spent £6,000 on having their drains fixed, ordinary voters can focus on that. And also the politicians are public figures who can be attacked and are attacked, whereas the bankers and the other people behind them are anonymous. Many people couldn't name most bankers, and certainly before the crisis and even now. And I think that we should be talking about what's catastrophically wrong with the economy, not about MPs' expenses. Not that I'm saying that they don't need to account for themselves.
Well, of course, MPs originally thought that these expenses were going to be private and that they'd arrange them on their own with the fees office, and that they thought that this was all okay, and suddenly it's all come out. It was kind of leaked, wasn't it?
Well, what it looks like to me is people need to realise that politicians have got a job to do in this crisis, and they're supposed to be taking charge of the situation on all of our behalfs, and that's from all the parties, all the party leaders. But having this expenses crisis means that they lack the authority to do what's necessary to re-regulate the banking system. And the bankers are laughing while we watch this Punch and Judy show.
So anyway, on the economic crisis, what's at the heart of the problem? Do you think businesses and the public are going to see any of this bailout money trickle
down?
No, because we're still hearing that people are finding it difficult to get mortgages and difficult to get loans, etc.
Well, as I've said on previous programmes in previous weeks, throwing money down the black hole of a bust banking system is not sensible. This is real resources that are being committed to this. And if you wanted to stimulate the economy, which of course we do need to do, it should be spent, the money should be spent into the real economy. Cut out the middlemen, stop propping the banks up. This is not going to do any good at all, because of course the money, once it's in the banks, is then sterilised. They don't lend it on. They're using it to offset these huge derivative bets that they've taken. So that what we're doing is chucking real taxpayer money down a black hole, and then that's the end of it. And of course it doesn't have any effect on the other side, because we've chucked it down a black hole.
Now, on to East-West relations, and Marina Morris is going to be looking at the NATO exercises in Georgia later on. How do you think things are going, the East-West relations between Russia and the West?
Well, it's obviously very tense for obvious reasons. I don't know if people saw, but the famous Polish pianist Zimmerman was a couple of weeks ago playing in Los Angeles. And before he played, he said, "I'm not going to play in the United States again, ever, because you were putting these missile defense sites on Polish soil, which is a provocation to the Russians. We don't want them. Please, can you take them away? And I'm not going to play again in the United States of America until you do." And I thought that was a very brave and solid stand from him.
I mean, should pianists, people like this, actually be kind of what he's trying to do is a bit of he's like an ambassador or something. He's trying to do diplomacy and not doing it very well.
Well, I think he's done a very good job there, actually. And don't forget that before the war, the Polish pianist Paderewski was also the prime minister. And I think there's a tradition in Poland of pianists being politically opinionated. So he's just filling in that gap.
Now, the other thing is, we've got in Greece, which has seen riots through the last few months, we've got the Bilderberg Conference meeting at the moment.
Yeah.
Now, do you think that this is an organisation which I've actually written quite a lot about in the past, but do you think it's really as dodgy as people make out? I mean, we've got there is mostly bankers who may be implicated with the financial crisis, and royalty and a smattering of industrialists. Do you think it's something that we should be interested in, this conference in Greece?
Well, I mean, that's a bit of a leading question since you're one of the world's experts on Bilderberg. Of course, this meeting is held every year, and as you know, it used to be completely secret. And most of the, no doubt they will be discussing the financial crisis and so on. And as you've pointed out in all the work you've done on them, they try to keep this secret. I mean, having meetings is one thing, but having secret meetings is something else. And as you pointed out previously, before the Iraq War, the meeting was all that they sat down and discussed it in Bilderberg, and then the Iraq War took place. It's a place where big decisions are taken behind closed doors.
Well, the whole peninsula of this place in where it's happening apparently has been completely sealed off, so yeah. Journalists can't get within half a mile of the hotel.
Well, as you know, they don't leave the venue out until the very last moment to make sure that there isn't any media coverage. And then, you know, they now do admit that they have the meetings, because, as you know, for many years they insisted that such meetings didn't take place at all until they were forced to admit that they did.
But surely the politicians, there are a smattering of them, they should be telling the Bilderberg people and the financial what to do.
I mean, obviously I've never been at a Bilderberg meeting, but I see the Bilderberg meetings as very like a horse fair, where the financial people buy the politicians. They look at their fetlocks, they look at their teeth, they decide whether they're worth buying. And, you know, Tony Blair, Clinton, all of these people, when they were up and coming, were invited along to be to have their flesh examined.
What about just coming back to a little bit more to reality? Now, you've had a bit of news today, haven't you? Because you found out yesterday you were due to be evicted at lunchtime.
Yes, yeah, so people, I'm in private rented accommodation, and the people who own the building have not been keeping up the mortgage, so now the Bank of Ireland have appeared with to try and kick us all out. And we were presented yesterday with an eviction order for 12:30 today.
That's not a lot of notice, is it? 24 hours.
There was no physical way we could have got out, even if we'd wanted to. But in actual fact, we went to court this morning and got the eviction notice overturned, not permanently, but just because the paperwork was not in order. But we're still facing eviction, all the people that live in the building. That's happening right across Bristol. I understand hundreds of people in this position.
But I wonder whether the banks and mortgage owners, the lenders and people like that, are playing fair, because it does sound like, you know, they shouldn't be trying to evict people with such short notice.
Well, I think the whole situation is new and difficult for people to understand how it's going to play out. The Bank of Ireland is itself bust, of course, and has been rescued by the Irish government. So you could argue that it's the Irish government that are trying to evict me. But of course, the point is that they are desperate to claw back money to cover their losses, and they've got other people chasing them. Yeah, I mean, we're chasing the banks in Iceland, the British local councils and so on. Everybody's chasing everybody else for money, and of course, there is no rationality. It's like a stampede. It would make more sense for us to stay in the building and pay rent to whoever owns it, but that's not the way it works, yeah? Because the system is just get them out, sell the building, on we go.
Well, this is the thing as well. If they want to sell the building, it might not necessarily sell straight away, might it? It's not a very good market at the moment.
And if this economy was stable and somebody had gone bust, they'd probably hold on to it and wait to sell it at a better time. But nobody can do that. Everybody needs the money now, any money they can get. So there's going to be an irrational wave of evictions and so on. There's already got waves of redundancy going through. So it's not just mortgagees. It's also private rented people who are going to end up being kicked out. And in the US, there's lots and lots of empty houses while people are sleeping in tent cities. It's just ridiculous.
So it's important that people are really aware of what the law is, and that if they do find themselves in that same situation as you were yesterday afternoon and this morning, that they know how to use the court system.
Well, that's right. And, of course, the British court system is based on case law. So we are creating case law as we go, which may protect people to some extent from the worst of the effects of this kind of process.
Thanks, Martin. And we'll be talking to you again about concerns about the 7/7 London bombings and the response to terrorist attacks later in the show. 2 weeks ago, we saw the collapse of what's been called the final criminal case relating to the 7/7 London bombings. Nobody's been successfully prosecuted for these atrocities, which killed 52 London commuters on the 7th of July 2005. In April 2006, the government released an anonymous narrative. As the final 7/7-related trial collapses in London, the fourth anniversary of the attacks approaches. Is that narrative enough, or is an independent inquiry needed? Earlier this week, the Home Office released statistics as well to show that only 13% of people arrested under the post-9/11 terrorism acts have been found to have done anything related to terrorism. Today, we ask the question, what really happened on the 7th of July 2005? How much or how little do we now know?
The headlines at 9 o'clock. In the past hour, there have been three major explosions on the London Underground. The first occurred at 8:10 on the Piccadilly line between Knightsbridge and Hyde Park Corner. The second at 8:16 on the central line between Tottenham Court Road and Oxford Circus. And the third at 8:27 as a train was arriving at Vauxhall Station from Stockwell on the Victoria line. Emergency services have been called to all three scenes. There are no reports available yet on the number of casualties, and the police have said that it's too early to identify a possible cause. London Underground is now closed, and the police are asking people not to travel.
Now, you may think that 7/7 live coverage was from the attacks themselves, but actually it was from a panorama programme a year or so before the attacks. Here's more from an internet documentary which uses clips from a programme which was actually aired on the BBC a year before the bombings themselves took place.
More than a year before the 7/7/2005 attacks, on the 16th of May 2004, an edition of the BBC One Panorama programme broadcasted a mock exercise imagining what would happen if a terrorist attack was executed in London in the near future, consisting of three explosions on tube trains in the London Underground and one explosion on a road vehicle. The following excerpt from the BBC programme gives us a good idea of why this programme was made.
If there are now bombs going off above ground, in this case a lorry being attacked, it could happen anywhere. So the potential for mass panic across not just the capital but the whole country is very much with us. I think therefore we need to look at more serious measures. We do have reserve powers in effect to take over the BBC if we were to wish to, and to get them to broadcast whatever we wanted them to broadcast. Those powers are there in the Broadcasting Act. My advice to the Prime Minister would be not to use those, but I think we should be talking to the broadcasters about having the Prime Minister on the air very quickly.
You wouldn't disagree with that, Michael, at all?
No, I entirely agree that the Prime Minister should be out there, and we shouldn't be using the powers to bring in the BBC, but we should certainly be talking to the broadcasters about the way in which the coverage is going to be organised.
Please note well that he said the coverage is going to be organised. In other words, he was saying that they would write the script for and then edit and control the media coverage of an event in which there were three explosions on London tube trains and one on a road vehicle. if such an event were to take place in the near future. The question that begs to be asked is this: was that what they were actually in the process of planning, and precisely the reason for that program?
This is the kind of terrorist attack the government repeatedly says is going to happen.
We've been absolutely clear, we can't guarantee that there will never be an attack. It's quite likely that they're planning one now.
I am wondering about the purpose and effect of this very programme.
This BBC Panorama programme appears to have been used by those behind the 7/7/2005 attack as the means by which the media's response to the attack in the near future was studied, so it could be controlled and directed towards their own ends.
Okay, so interestingly enough, the producer of that film, the 7/7 Ripple Effect, which is an intimate film, was in jail recently in Ireland, awaiting extradition to the UK. He's now out on bail for allegedly sending his film to the judge and jury in the last 7/7 case, which recently collapsed. As the London bombings of 7th of July 2005 come under the spotlight, why was there an exercise going on that morning at the same three tube stations? Here's a clip from Canadian television, which was transmitted on the weekend after the attacks.
The World Conference on Disaster Management. It's the biggest conference on disaster management in the world. Adrian Gordon is the executive director of the Canadian Centre for Emergency Preparedness, and Peter Power is the managing director of a consulting firm based in London that specializes in crisis management. Thanks, both of you, for being here. Peter, let's start with you. We've heard something quite extraordinary. Could be a coincidence or not, that your firm, on the very day that the bombs went off in London, were running an exercise simulating three bombs going off in the very same tube stations that they went on. How did this happen? Coincidence, or were you acting on information that you knew?
I don't think we can say that we had some special insight to the terrorist network, otherwise I'd be under arrest myself. The truth of it is...
But it is a coincidence.
It's a coincidence, and it's a spooky coincidence. Our scenario was very similar. It wasn't totally identical, but it was based on bombs going off to the time, the location, all this sort of stuff. But it wasn't an accident in the sense that London has a history of bombs. And the reason why our emergency services did so well and prepared probably better than any other city in the world, sadly, they have to be. So it wasn't exactly rocket science or totally out of the pale to come up with that scenario. Unusual though it did, so we had to stop the exercise and go into real time, and it worked very well. Although there was a few seconds when the audience didn't realise whether it was real or not.
The chap running it says it was a spooky coincidence, but is it that simple? And why have the government and opposition parties continued to block an inquiry? Were the four Muslim men alleged to be behind the attacks really the bombers, and was anyone else involved? Well, one of the biggest problems with the official story is the lack of CCTV pictures of the four alleged bombers on the tube that day. Some CCTV images have been released, but only from a trip made 9 days previously. You can understand why people are confused, because BBC News and others have shown these images with the date stamp showing the 28th of June 2005 actually removed from the image. Anyway, about 9 months before the bomb attack, London Underground was privatised against the wishes of Mayor Ken and Londoners. One of the companies that won a CCTV contract is the Israeli firm Verint Systems. Verint changed their name from Comverse Infosys after they were involved in a big scandal in the United States, where the FBI believed Comverse were the same, that same company won the underground CCTV contract. This is a report from US television back in 2001.
As Carl Cameron reported, U.S. investigators digging into the 9/11 terrorist attacks fear that suspects may have been tipped off to what they were doing by information leaking out of Amdocs. In tonight's report, we learned that the concern about phone security extends to another company founded in Israel that provides the technology that the U.S. government uses for electronic eavesdropping. Here is Carl Cameron's third report.
The company is Comverse Infosys, a subsidiary of an Israeli-run private telecommunications firm with offices throughout the U.S. It provides wiretapping equipment for law enforcement. Here's how wiretapping works in the U.S. Every time you make a call, it passes through the nation's elaborate network of switchers and routers run by the phone companies. Custom computers and software made by companies like Comverse are tied into that network to intercept, record, and store the wiretapped calls, and at the same time transmit them to investigators. The manufacturers have continuing access to the computers so they can service them and keep them free of glitches. This process was authorized by the 1994 Communications Assistance for Law Enforcement Act, or CALEA. Senior government officials have now told Fox News that while CALEA made wiretapping easier, it has led to a system that is seriously vulnerable to compromise and may have undermined the whole wiretapping system. Indeed, Fox News has learned that Attorney General John Ashcroft and FBI Director Robert Mueller were both warned October 18th in a hand-delivered letter from 15 local, state, and federal law enforcement officials who complained that, quote, law enforcement's current electronic surveillance capabilities are less effective today than they were at the time CALEA was enacted. Converse insists the equipment it installs is secure, but the complaint about this system is that the wiretap computer programs made by Converse have, in effect, a back door through which wiretaps themselves can be intercepted by unauthorized parties. Adding to the suspicions is the fact that in Israel, Converse works closely with the Israeli government and under special programs gets reimbursed for up to 50% of its research and development costs by the Israeli Ministry of Industry and Trade. But investigators within the DEA, INS, and FBI have all told Fox News that to pursue or even suggest Israeli spying through Converse is considered career suicide. And sources say that while various FBI inquiries into Converse have been conducted over the years, they've been halted before the actual equipment has ever been thoroughly tested for leaks. A 1999 FCC document indicates several government agencies expressed deep concerns that too many unauthorized, non-law enforcement personnel can access the wiretap system. And the FBI's own nondescript office in Chantilly, Virginia, that actually oversees the CALEA wiretapping program, is among the most agitated about the threat. But there is a bitter turf war internally at FBI. It is the FBI's office in Quantico, Virginia, that has jurisdiction over awarding contracts and buying intercept equipment. And for years, they've thrown much of the business to Converse. A handful of former U.S. law enforcement officials involved in awarding Converse government contracts over the years now work for the company. Numerous sources say some of those individuals were asked to leave government service under what knowledgeable sources call troublesome circumstances that remain under administrative review within the Justice Department. And what troubles investigators most, particularly in New York, in the counterterrorism investigation of the World Trade Center attack, is that on a number of cases, suspects that they had sought to wiretap and surveil immediately changed their telecommunications processes. They started acting much differently as soon as those supposedly secret wiretaps went into place. Brett?
Carl, is there any reason to suspect in this instance that the Israeli government is involved?
No, there's not, but there are growing instincts in an awful lot of law enforcement officials in a variety of agencies who suspect that and have begun compiling evidence and a highly classified investigation into precisely that possibility. Brett?
All right, Carl. Thanks very much.
Carl Cameron's report there from Fox News in the USA back in December 2001. Talking about the Israeli firm with close links to the intelligence services and holder of the London CCTV, or at least one of the London CCTV contracts. But it doesn't stop there. When the FBI tried to arrest Converse chief executive Kobe Alexander over several counts of theft and fraud, their shares were suspended from the New York Stock Exchange and he did a runner with $13 million to Namibia, where apparently he still is. Britain's Muslims have been in a particularly difficult position with regard to the London bombings, being blamed collectively for as yet unproven acts of four men. Dr. Nassim is the chairman of the Birmingham Central Mosque, and he believes the so-called Muslim fringe groups like Al-Mujarun don't adhere to the Quran and may be leaving themselves open to manipulation by Western intelligence agencies.
I came into contact with them at the time of Bosnia, when Bosnia was attacked and there was a conflict going on. And I had a meeting here in this hall, which was attended by citizens of this city, mostly non-Muslim, of all kind of persuasion. And what amazed me is that some young people barged into the hall and said, "You are doing this against Islam. You have got non-Muslims in the mosque. And that is forbidden." And I have never come across this opinion before in my life. And I was surprised that these people who are supposed to be working for Islam are presenting a picture of Islam, which is absolutely wrong. And it can only be presented if you want to put Muslim people away from Islam. Now, on that premise, I invited them to, because I wanted to know more. That was my perception, but I could have been wrong. I invited them to have it, come and have a discussion. They promised and they never turned up. It happened two or three times, and then I was once invited to a meeting where Umar Bakri was present. So it was a meeting arranged for me to talk to Umar Bakri because his juniors did not feel qualified to talk to me. I spoke to him. I had one sitting, and I pointed the error of his opinion. And then there was a second meeting was arranged, and he never turned up. The thing is, there is no way they can interpret the Quran the way they are interpreting. That is a problem. Because I could not understand how anybody could present this, because this was an emotional presentation of the Quran. There was no justification. If you are ignorant, then you can sell this story. If you're not ignorant, you couldn't sell it to anybody. And that's what these people were doing. Democracy is forbidden. Non-Muslims should not be allowed in. Now they didn't know them. In Prophet's time, a delegation of Christians came to the mosque, 60 people, headed by an archbishop. They stayed for 1 week in the mosque. They said their prayers in the mosque. And I checked with the Roman Catholic bishop here as to how many prayers were they supposed to perform in a day at that time. And he said about three or five. So that means Muslims were saying their five-time prayer, Christians were saying their prayer at the same time, and as Protestantism was not there at that time, they must have imagery. So they must have been allowed to use their imagery in performing their prayer. So how could any Muslim say that they are forbidden? And there's a whole chapter in the Quran devoted to that incident when these people came and stayed in the Prophet's mosque. So that is why I say there's no way you can present another picture, because it is there in black and white. Who would be interested in creating this picture of Muslim unless it is somebody who has already said the rules of the games have changed? So we can tell lies, we can do anything as long as it serves our political purpose. So I concluded, as a deduction from that premise, that they must have link with organizations or representatives of that political system which is interested in creating this impression amongst non-Muslims.
That was Dr. Nassim, chairman of the Birmingham Central Mosque, explaining his doubts about the authenticity of some of these Muslim fringe groups. On to one of the survivors now, and Daniel Obichiki says that he was downstairs on the number 30 bus when it blew up. Despite being interviewed by national newspapers, they won't print his testimony. Is Daniel crazy, or is he being silenced as part of a cover-up?
Today we're going to deal with something which many people have tried to find out a lot about, which is the Peter Power terror drills. These were four terror drills which were concurrent with the explosions, more or less, on July the 7th, 2005. And many people have asked me, after reading my book or hearing about it, what I saw about it, because I only briefly mentioned what I saw. Some of you may not know, there was what they call a triage point on Tavistock Square itself, on the grass of Tavistock Square. And I saw this in the first 60 seconds when I ran down Tavistock Square after fleeing my flight from the bus which was blown up. So you've got to ask yourself, if I saw this, I saw the bandaged man, I saw the man with a camera, I heard wailing voice, I looked across the road, and I saw a young man in a fluorescent bib. If you take a look at the handout I've made, it shows you, on the second point, the young man in a fluorescent bib across the road. Now, there were people who were actually trained. They were part of this terror drill, which Peter Power says up to 1,000 people were involved. Now, 1,000 people involved, that means there are at least 250 in each location. So we have to ask ourselves, who were these people? Can we identify them? And maybe there were more than four actual locations, because there was a lot of radio talk about there being six locations. The explosion was at the back of the bus. From where I was downstairs, I was standing in the part where baby buggies are normally kept. And what happened was the blast happened, the back of the bus kind of collapsed on top of the three ladies sitting on the back seats, on the back two seats. One of them, I never saw her again. Two of them were on the floor huddled down where I was, and they were about to scream. I don't know what, but nothing came out of their mouth. They were just in total fear and shock. So I departed to the right and I just ran off that bus in about within 10 or 15 seconds. But the blast actually tore the top of the bus off. And that meant that the people at the front were more or less unharmed, but the people at the back were sprawn, their remnants were sprawn all over the Tavistock Square. In fact, the blast was such that it jolted the bus forward about 6 or 7 feet. It acted like a boost because the driver had actually come to a halt, and the bus kind of jerked forward as well. I noticed that when I fell and hit the floor. Now, the thing that I kind of found confusing, they went to these people and said, can you please explain what happened on that bus? Now, they have people like this lady who says she doesn't remember anything about the blast at all. And she had to be helped off the bus about 15 minutes afterwards. The two girls on the floor were too frightened to leave the bus. I just got out of there because I thought about, hey, maybe there's a secondary explosion about to take place. But the two girls were like cowering on the floor. Obviously, they had no idea what was going on. But I knew instantly that it was a bomb, so I decided to get out of there. Now, for whatever reason, the media began to seek out survivors who had no recollection of the blast. And that's why today we're still scrambling around for this kind of proof. And the only proof up until now that things were pre-planned are Peter Power himself. Oh, there's no evidence of any Asian person on the bus and on the lower deck of the bus.
I mean, he probably would have blown himself to pieces anyway, so how would you know? I mean,
so they say.
It's an important thing. You're on the lower deck.
Yeah.
You're not necessarily going to know if there's an Asian guy upstairs.
I boarded that bus at Euston. I was about the fourth person to board it. I pushed in, okay? It was hectic out there, and I just wanted to get to work. So I actually stood there, and I asked the bus driver a question. I said, does this bus go to Angel? And then he said, no. And then I looked at him because I tried to get on the previous bus, and the African driver, the same African driver I showed you in that picture, told me you have to get the 30 from over there. So that made me doubt what the number 30 bus driver was saying, because this guy here had told me to get the next bus, and I got the next bus. Anyway, so for that reason, I stood downstairs and waited for people to go past me, and they were all asking questions. They were as lost as me and saying, does this bus go here? Does this bus go King's Cross? Does this bus go everywhere? And then no one fit in the description of that guy. I think his name's Hasib Hussein. He's some big hefty guy with a big massive rucksack. Now, I was standing there, people were brushing past me. I never saw no big hench guy with a rucksack go past me. That's it. Now, people might like to speculate that he was already on board the bus from a previous bus stop. I mean, that's something which someone has tried to suggest. I actually saw an individual with a grey, light grey top and a dark grey two-tone rucksack, brown hair, who was sitting upstairs. He had a rucksack. Then he came downstairs. I'm standing downstairs. I'm saying, why is the guy sitting upstairs, then sitting downstairs? To me, I came to the conclusion that he must have been the bomber. He must have planted something upstairs, then sat downstairs. And obviously he got off in the minute before the bomb went off, when the bus driver opened the doors for no apparent reason when there was no bus stop.
Well, that, he sounds like an interesting chap, so I don't know if you can you just give us as full a description as you can of what he was doing?
He was a European male in his mid-20s, brown, mousy hair. I remember his water kind of showerproof top. It was light grey, and the two-tone rucksack. And that's all I really remember of him. He did look at me hesitantly a couple of times, and I looked back at him. I thought he was just another lost kind of person. I thought that's what the reason he was looking at me. And he got off. He was actually the very last person to get off that bus before the driver shut the door, and then the bomb went off 60 seconds or so later.
See, now, many people might speculate that how come you can remember so much about this. Most people, when they're on the bus, if you were to tell them who went upstairs, who went downstairs, they would remember nothing.
I remember this like it was yesterday. I mean, for some reason, I was standing there. I was really thinking, I shouldn't be on this bus. I should be on the bus in front. That's why I was getting a bit agitated there, and I was seeing what was going on, the delays, and I was looking out the window and saying, why the hell is this bus getting nowhere? So when you're in that state, looking at things and questioning everything, that's how I am as a person, I suppose. I mean, I saw this guy, and the thing which made me ask questions was, why did the bus driver stop the bus when nobody had rung the bell and open the middle doors and not open the front doors? That's what he did. And that's quite a few people got off from upstairs, a few people from downstairs as well. And then the very last person was this European man with brown hair, a light grey rainproof top, and a two-tone dark grey rucksack. So to me, that speaks volumes, because you have to ask yourself, things normally happen naturally. You ring the bell, bus driver stops, you get off. The bus driver doesn't just stop, open the doors, and no one rang the bell, okay? That's all I'm saying. That was an irregularity which drew my attention.
That was Daniel Obachicki speaking, who says he was on the number 30 bus, which exploded on 7-7 in Tavistock Square. So is Daniel crazy, or is he being silenced as part of a cover-up? And you can find Daniel's blog on the web at www.thefourthbomb, that's the number 4, thefourthbomb.com, and he's written a book also called The Fourth Bomb. One thing unites almost all researchers, as well as 7-7 survivors and families of the victims: the need for an independent inquiry into what happened that day. But what do you think? We went out onto the streets of Bristol to find out.
Yes, I think there should be a public inquiry, because in the interest of public should know that what happened, and there should be a detailed inquiry about whoever is involved, or whatever is involved, whatever has happened, there should be a detailed inquiry about that, in the public interest, basically. Then people will have faith that the government is acting in the best interest of the victim, as well as the people who are basically affected by it, mentally, psychologically or physically. And it will be interest of the community as well, because Britain is a multicultural society.
I don't think it's necessary, because I think that everybody understands what happened and the reasons it happened. I think you have to look at statistics. It's much more dangerous, for example, to drive, or, you know, more people die of heart attacks because they didn't eat well than die from things like terrorism.
No, I don't actually. Only because I think that it was all dealt with in a very professional manner. So I don't see the need that it should be delved in too deeply in that way.
Yeah, should be, but I don't think they will, but they should do, yes. Because people lost their lives.
Has there not been, yes? I wasn't aware. I don't know, so yes, I guess so, yeah.
I mean, surely the police must have had a case, you know, for this in the beginning, so why did it collapse? Yeah, we should find out why it all happened. If they are terrorists, okay, then we want to find out, and if they've got away with it, and we definitely want to find out. If they're not terrorists, fair enough, you know. Well, I suppose you could say, I don't know, just the way things are these days, aren't they? They're not from my era, this day and age. People just don't seem to care. They seem to pass the buck, get rid of it, and so on. Money, you name it, they got it, don't be bothered. Then it's like the police, isn't it? Arrest the easy ones and let the bad ones go, you know. We've got public support. There's a lot of good coppers, right? I got to admit, but they're limited by all their red tape and all the rest of it. Okay, and then you've got the bad ones that are going to be thumping the people up in the G20. I mean, it spoils it for all the rest of those guys. You know, so, you know, there's a lot of good coppers around, there's no arguing about it. But when you get a couple of, like a sergeant hitting that woman, that was wrong. And when they got that poor guy for the news vendor, that was totally wrong. So that's where the police's image is going wrong. And then they don't seem to care. So when they can do that to people, right, then they're not going to go around looking at your terrorists. Okay,
so do you...
their priorities wrong, haven't they?
So do you think, what do you think it would achieve if there was an inquiry?
What do you see? What's the truth? What went wrong and why it went wrong and why didn't they do this or do that and all this kind of thing? What you need to do is like America, and they're talking about it now, and I think the only way you're going to get out of these kind of things is to elect your chief constable. Then the guy knows he's got to operate, right, to please the public, as he won't be in the job again. These days he's fitted probably politically, like London, Blair. He was political, wasn't he? And anything. So the only way, you know, if somebody wants to look at it, it's all the promises, 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 but what do we get? Nothing. We're always worse off, especially Gordon Brown and his mob, because can't trust them. So they're not interested. So if not, they were sorted law and order a long time ago.
It should be, yes. There should be. I mean, whoever is guilty should be brought to justice.
Yeah, I mean, definitely, they should go ahead with the inquiry. They should not stop whatsoever and continue asking and looking for the tip from anywhere in the world, actually. So, yeah, they should.
And again, it's all closed doors. I mean, I think if a proper inquiry has been done, it should be, all the details should be brought forward to the public. And I think not everything is transparent about what's going on. It should be transparent enough. The whole process should be transparent enough.
Yeah, I agree with him. The whole process should be transparent enough, and we should know what's going on rather than just getting that we are still processing the inquiry. Well, till when what you found and what you have, you should at least disclose to the normal public rather than keeping behind closed doors.
I thought that already had been a public inquiry, but so it shows I'm not too well informed. No, we entirely need to investigate, but I think the police are doing a good job in what they've done. I mean, we've had no big incidents since, so I think they are working hard doing what they're doing. But we've also got to take into account the rights of the individuals involved, and if we can't nail them down, we can't lock them up forever. Intelligence failure, in a way, I mean, they were being followed, so the intelligence were onto them, but they just got through the net. What we don't hear about is all the good work they've done that they can't tell us about, so I'm confident that, you know, a lot of good work is being done, but we just don't hear about it.
Okay, well, what about if there was an inquiry? Do you think it would achieve anything, a proper inquiry, which could subpoena witnesses and that sort of thing?
Hopefully so well done and well managed. I wouldn't want to see another waste of public money. That happens a lot whenever the politicians get involved. But, yeah.
Like everything else with these things, when they say they've got these people for something or other, it turns out they don't. Whether or not they are doing that, it's a matter of, say, they've got to be seen to be doing something, and they probably aren't.
If there is an inquiry, do you think it would actually achieve anything, or do you think we should just forget about it and move on?
Well, being a bit of a conspiracy theorist, I probably think it'd be a waste of time. But the point is, these things can be manipulated, can't they? So who's to say? I mean, they might go through the motions and just sort of pretend that they're trying to do something, but are they? I don't know. I really don't know. Well, the same happened countrywide, where they arrested about 10 or 11 of these people, and because they was about to avoid a big terrorist threat, and they let them all go. I mean, where was this terrorist threat they was talking about? I mean, where was the how good was his intelligence?
So that was our reporter Marina Morris and myself out on the streets of Bristol earlier this week, finding out whether you think an inquiry is needed. I'm joined again by Martin Summers. Martin, there's lots of unanswered questions there, aren't there?
Yes, indeed there are.
The ones we've heard of, are there any others that we haven't touched on?
Well, the things that raise questions in my mind about the attacks are two things in particular. The Metropolitan Police, in the aftermath of the attacks, named an individual who they thought might be the mastermind or quartermaster of the attacks. That individual was Harun Rashid Aswat. Harun Rashid Aswat has a record as an Islamist militant, and he spoke to all of the bombers by telephone. We know this. Spoke to all of them on by mobile phone in the week before the attack. So the Metropolitan Police pointed him out as a potential mastermind, and he was arrested. But John Loftus, who's a former Attorney General in the United States, went on TV in the United States and said that as far as the US authorities were concerned, Aswat was an MI6 double agent. The Americans have been trying to catch him for many years for running an training camp in Oregon for militants. But he was arrested in various countries as he travelled around the world, including Namibia. He was let go. And he was let go because the British authorities leaned on whoever had arrested him and said, he may look like an Islamist militant, but he's actually working for us, which is why he was let go. Guess where he is now? He's been arrested. He's not been put on trial. He's not been put on trial in anything to do with 7/7. He was originally being held in Belmarsh under these kind of anti-terrorist legislation where you don't need to prove anything about holding them. And he's now in Broadmoor because he's apparently gone mad. And what that looks like to me is that he may well have been the mastermind stroke quartermaster, but he was an MI6 agent. And now, of course, they've double-crossed him and they've just incarcerated him in Broadmoor. Now, I'm not saying that is what's happened. I'm just saying that's one construction that might be made.
So you're saying that maybe
an inquiry might get to the bottom of something.
So maybe we haven't heard the last of 7/7 as regards criminal trials yet.
Well, I don't know. I mean, an inquiry is to look at every aspect of what's happened here. Another very important point that people need to recognise is that on the morning of the attack, Benjamin Netanyahu, who is currently the Prime Minister of Israel, was the finance minister of Israel at that time, and he was supposed to be at a meeting at Liverpool Street, near Liverpool Street Station, at 9 o'clock in the morning of the morning of the attack. He didn't turn up to that meeting, and the Israeli authorities in Israel issued a statement saying that he hadn't turned up to the meeting because they had had a warning of the attack. This came up through Reuters and then then disappeared.
I know it was in quite a few English language papers around the world, including the Canadian.
Yeah, so in other words, the Israelis have now said, oh no, we never said any such thing, but it's all on the record that they did indeed say such a thing. And of course, they then pointed the finger. They said, well, where did you get this warning from? They said, oh, from the Metropolitan Police. But when Paddock was in charge of the investigation, he gave a press conference saying, well, we gave them no warning. We had no warning ourselves. It was no warning attack. So, and he didn't turn up to the meeting, yeah? So that they had to give him some kind of explanation. Now, at the very least, that suggests foreknowledge. And if I had been in charge of the investigation, when I'd found out that the Israelis had a warning or claimed to have had a warning about the attack, I would have sealed off the Israeli embassy, cut off the electricity and the water, and I would have said, nobody is leaving here until you explain where and how you got this so-called warning of a complete surprise attack, supposedly. Now, I'm not saying any of this adds up to anything more than questions, but they are questions that deserve answers.
Yeah. Well, given that much of this does demand some sort of an inquiry, what makes you think that an inquiry into 7/7 would actually get to the truth? As one of the people in the street said, you know, that we've had the David Kelly report, which was what many people think was a whitewash.
Well, that is always going to be an issue, is who's going to control an inquiry and so on. I mean, if you remember the inquiry into the 9/11 attacks, the government didn't want any kind of inquiry at all until the Jersey girls who were bereaved on the day pushed and pushed and pushed, and they forced them to have an inquiry. And the Thomas Keane, who headed up the inquiry, subsequently said that they were told a lot of rubbish and that he's not happy with the report as it finally came out, that the government did in fact try to control the inquiry and so on. But it's like forcing open a big oak door, isn't it? You've just got to keep pushing. And if the inquiry that you have isn't good enough, well, you have to have another one that is good enough. Because at the very least, there have been failures, security failures here. The police at first said they were all complete clean skins, the so-called bombers, and they had no record or trace of them. And then it transpired that they had, in fact, been watching them. So at the very least, there's questions about competence there. But there's possibly more than that. much more.
Well, you talk about intelligence failures. The Parliament's Intelligence and Security Committee has actually done a report into the British intelligence MI5, MI6 failures in the run-up to 7/7, and that couldn't be released because of the ongoing trials, which collapsed a couple of weeks ago. And that report, I believe, is due to be released next Tuesday.
Well, that'll be interesting to see what's in it.
Political pundit Martin Summers there, and he'll be back next week. Finally, let's have a look at some of the books and films on the 7/7 London bombings for anyone who wants to read up more on the subject. Probably the most comprehensive is one called London Bombings, an Independent Inquiry by academic Nafees Ahmed. And also there are documentaries which have been released on the internet. BT London Bombings 2005 is probably the most enigmatic, completely anonymous with no voiceover, just words on the screen. That was released on BitTorrent only a few days after the attacks and went through about five or six different versions. Then there's one called 7/7 The Ripple Effect, which we heard a bit from earlier. But probably the best is called Ludicrous Diversion. That came out in 2006, a very professionally made film, again anonymous, but it's probably the best. It's based on a Tony Blair quote that an inquiry would be a ludicrous diversion. And finally, the official campaign for an inquiry into 7/7, you can find that on the internet at www.july7th.co.uk. Okay, thanks very much, Martin, and we'll be hearing a little bit from you next week. Now, our reporter, Marina Morris, is with us, and as I said earlier on, she'll be taking over from Quentin Marceron. Now he's off back to France. Hi, Marina. Nice to see you.
Hi.
Now, you worked for radio over in the Ukraine and other similar countries, didn't you?
Yes.
Whereabouts have you? Did you work?
I work on the TV company, radio TV company.
Okay, so you've got something for us today. The war between NATO and Russia,
yes,
for control of Georgia. Well, it was over last year, but the saber rattling continues. Marina, you have a report, don't you, on NATO's military exercises this week in Georgia, which are upsetting the Russians.
NATO is in the middle of a three-week exercise in Georgia. More than 1,000 soldiers from NATO countries, including the United States, are simulated a response to a crisis and holding peacekeeping exercise at the Georgia military base, formerly used by the Russian Air Force. This is taking place close to area where Russian troops are stationed in Georgia's breakaway region of South Ossetia. Russia has criticized the NATO exercise on its southern flank as a muscle flexing. Russia's envoy to NATO, Dmitry Rogozin, said the alliance would be better off holding the maneuvers in a mud house than in a country where troops were rioting against their own president. Georgia now is in the middle of two great powers. President Saakashvili has made a membership of NATO one of his main goals, and NATO agreed in April 2008 that Georgia would become a member of the alliance at some unspecified date in the future. His domestic opponents have paralyzed the capital Tbilisi with a week of protest demanding he resigned over his record on democracy and last year's war. What has been learned since the war last year? President Barack Obama has said the United States and Russia have an excellent opportunity to improve relations on a whole host of issues on the meeting with Russia Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov. Obama will visit Moscow the 6th of July. But now the tug of war continues. Georgia's son in the Eurovision in Moscow was disqualified for attacking Russian Prime Minister Putin. Culture can help normal relations between Russia and Georgia. But can war games?
That was lovely. And I hope to hear more reports from stuff to do with Eastern Europe and maybe even stuff to do with Britain in the weeks to come, Marina. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Now it's time to hand over to Colin Power, who was with Carl Saxon again this week as well, who, as laymen in Bristol, have been doing a practical exploration of the British court system. Now, I did describe you earlier on as a bit of a jailbird, Colin.
I just had a little brief experience in the old the prison cell. It's my first time. I was a virgin to the experience before. I thought it was quite an incredible experience, actually.
Well, most people wouldn't put it like that, would they? Can you just describe some of the circumstances? Why was it that you actually found yourself in the cell?
Well, we tried to go into this court and I tried to present, you know, represent myself, as it were.
We put a lot of effort into our paperwork, and it was pretty good, but well, maybe not quite good enough.
Well, no, I don't think it was actually the paperwork, because I think that was one of the reasons, actually, why it might have actually happened, that I actually got transferred into the prison, so that because I seemed to get moved out of the magistrates in Bristol and into Bath. So I think that was a kind of step up, really.
So do you see this as a victory? It can't really be a victory, can it, in your battle to understand the legal system, to actually wind up in the cell? That sounds like a failure.
It was a full-on prison, not just a cell, was it?
Mm. Yeah, I was actually booked into a prison and everything like that, and I had a... Well, it depends. One of the things I really got out of it is actually, you know, a lot of empathy for, you know, some of the people who are finding themselves. Yeah, you know, give a big shout out there for anyone who's you know, related to anyone in prison at the moment, because, you know, I've been chatting to some of the guys on the other side, and you know, actually there is a lot of things, you know, that, you know, we don't really think about that kind of side of society that much, and yeah, there's a lot of suffering going on there, and you know, my heartfelt prayers go out to a lot of people who I met that night. So
so it was only one night, was it?
Literally just one night, and then bang out into Bath, basically, yeah.
If anyone out there has nerves of steel and they're up in court very soon, then I'd recommend when the judge tries to call you Mr. So-and-so, try saying, no, I'm not that person, I'm a man on the land. And maybe hold your birth certificate, but as I said, you will need nerves of steel.
Yeah, they don't take it too well if you try and...
Don't take it well at all.
Yeah, I mean, at the end of the day, you know, we're supposed to understand the law, aren't we, as it were, which means, you know, we're not supposed to be just sort of like subject to laws we don't understand. And yeah, I had sent what was known as a letter of amicus curiae.
Friend of the court.
Exactly. Which meant that I was actually coming there, you know, to settle the matter. You know, I wouldn't want to, I was trying to tell them I'm not legally trained, I'm going to be representing myself, you know, and I'm going to be going down there. And
Sounds to me like a lesson to, you know, you should get a solicitor.
Well, possibly. I don't know. Personally, actually, I learned a lot, actually. And... do you know what? Actually, the thing is, it's actually incredibly difficult to stand in a court without a solicitor, is what I'm finding.
And when the court ignores all your paperwork and pretends they haven't received it as well, it really doesn't help matters.
Now, I know some people have been following our show these last couple of weeks and have been sort of following the thread of what we've been talking about here. One of the questions I sort of had in my mind is that whenever you turn up in one of these places, there's always an intense amount of pressure for you to get legal aid. Yeah.
And mental assistance as well.
Yeah. Now, all of this, and, you know, and health checks and everything like that. So, but one of the things I would say is, you know, actually to get into a court and speak on your own two feet is one of the most difficult challenges I've had to face so far. And I still haven't yet properly achieved it. So hopefully, at one point in the future, we will actually get there and say our piece.
Well, you're just about out of jail now, but I expect a full report next week on exactly what happened to you. I just have to say, well, it's nearly 6 o'clock, and that's all we have time for this week. Join us on Friday drive time here on BCFM, where we'll be doing our level best to analyse the less well-reported events in Bristol, Britain and around the world. So next week, we take a look at the post office, teetering on the brink of privatisation and all that will bring. Will it be privatised? And if it is... will the daily delivery and universal service become things of the past?